Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did the incalculable cultural wealth of Italy survive the Allied bombings of the Second World War and escape the greedy clutches of Hitler and his underlings? The fighting in Italy nearly destroyed Da Vinci's Last Supper, left the magnificent frescoes of Camposanto shattered like a jigsaw puzzle, and opened the door for the Nazis to claim ownership of truckloads of paintings, sculptures, and other works. But as my guest today will tell us, an American artist and an art historian left the comfort and safety of academic life to venture into the fray and coordinate the protection, recovery, and eventual return of thousands of humanity's greatest works from all over Italy. Robert Edsel is founder and president of the Monuments Men Foundation and a recipient of the National Humanities Medal. His 2010 book, The Monuments Men, is currently being made into a movie starring George Clooney, Cate Blanchett, and Matt Damon. And his new book is called Saving Italy, The Race to Save a Nation's Treasures from the Nazis. Robert, welcome back to Think.
Thanks, Chris.
So initially, this story was part of your book on the Monuments Men. It had to be edited out to get the manuscript down to a manageable size. Do you think in hindsight it works better as a separate volume?
I do. And you know, sometimes it's funny in life, things work out a way different than what you're hoping for, and you're better off as a result of it. The story is so much different than the Monuments Men because in Northern Europe, the story we tell in the Monuments Men, Hitler's ambition really is the confiscation of works of art, some destined for this museum he intends to build in his hometown of Linz, the Führer Museum. Of course, Goering is constantly adding to his growing collection. The thefts are targeting, in many cases, Jews and Jewish art dealers. And it's on an industrial scale. In Italy, it's much more nuanced. Italy's an ally of Nazi Germany the first 3 years of the war. And as a result, there's really kind of a hands-off policy on deliberate cultural looting. There are cases of works of art that Mussolini agrees to allow to be exported out of his country in violation of the laws to curry favor with Hitler and with Goering. But when Italy changes sides in September 1943, all things change. There's wanton destruction by German troops that are embittered about their allies switching sides. There is overt looting that takes place. And this is really the cauldron that the monuments officers arrive to. So it's a much, much more, I think, targeted story to tell. And it's really fortunate that we broke it out.
So how did the Nazis proceed to claim and remove masterpieces before the alliance actually switched?
Well, Hitler would make the key momentous event in the whole story of the looting throughout Europe is this visit of Hitler's to Florence in May 1938. He makes his first formal state visit to Italy. He goes to Rome, he goes to Naples, back to Rome, and then comes to Florence. He only has 10 hours left in this five-day trip, of which he allocates 2 hours to go look at the art museums. And he walks through the Pitti Palace and walks across the Vasari Quarter over the Arno River and looks at the bridges, which is a fateful prognostication of what's going to come some 6 years later when all the bridges save the Ponte Vecchio are blown up by the Nazis, and then wanders through the Uffizi, an artist walking among artists, seeing works of art he'd only seen in books before or sculpture that he'd seen in study galleries. And it's there that this idea of this Linz Museum or Führer Museum really gels in his mind because he sees how glorious it is and the power of the Medicis and other collectors of these works of art, and goes back and begins in earnest making these drawings of the kind of museum he wants to have and empowering museum directors to begin this targeted list of works of art that he intends to have in his museum. So Florence is really ground central for the gelling of this idea, and it's something that I didn't fully appreciate in the writing of Monuments Men that emerged in the research for my most recent book, Saving Italy.
You actually lived in Florence.
I lived in Florence for 5 years, and in fact, you mentioned the two key characters we tell the story through, Dean Keller, who's a 42-year-old portrait painter and professor of art at Yale. I was 42 when I went to Florence. Mm-hmm. Dean Keller left behind his 3-year-old son and wouldn't see him for his next two birthdays. My 3-year-old son was with me. Mm-hmm. So there were many parallels in this story, and yet for all the years I lived in Florence, I didn't know who the Monuments Men were. This is where the idea came up, my curiosity about it. But only in the process of the research for this book did I start to realize I was living in a home next to a home that a monuments officer when he was a landscape architect, had designed the gardens. The building next to us had suffered shell damage during the battle for Florence. All the places I used to walk were the subject of our research, and it was an extraordinary experience for me, really out of body in a way from that of just being a researcher and an author.
So remind people who maybe didn't read the first book about the project that the Monuments Men were tasked with, and the kinds of resources they had, and where they came from, because these were not 22-year-old soldiers.
No, that's a great question. The Monuments Men were museum directors, curators, art historians, and artists themselves. Many were from the academic world, as you pointed out earlier, who middle aged, about 40 years old, men and women. Of course, the men alone were in combat, but women played an important role working with maps, and many of them had also been educated in Europe. So all of these men and women, for the most part, spoke multiple languages. They had an understanding of a great sensitivity towards the culture in Europe. Dean Keller, one of our two key figures, actually was a student in Italy from 1926 to 29 in Rome. Fred Hart, the other key figure in our story, was a 29-year-old budding art historian of great promise. Everyone could see this man was going somewhere. And for your listeners that have had any courses in the art of the Renaissance, they've probably had Fred Hart's handbook, which is still used today. They volunteered for service during World War II. Many of them that were professors watched their classes dwindle down to nothing because all the boys, as they referred to them, had either been drafted or volunteered for service. And they felt they had a contribution to make. So they volunteered for military service and became a new kind of soldier, one charged with saving rather than destroying.
So Fred Hart's style was very different from Dean Keller's.
Yeah, I think some people that have looked into this have drawn the wrong conclusions. I mean, Fred Hart at 29 was impetuous. He was deeply passionate and emotional. He was reckless oftentimes with his behavior. Dean Keller, on the other hand, was much more conservative and very methodical about how he would go about doing things. And I think the key nuance, having been a man of 29 and a man of 42, Hart is in that idealistic stage where he wants to save everything. Mm-hmm. He doesn't understand why Army engineers can't just be given orders to avoid knocking down buildings that perhaps could be repaired, not appreciating the fact that the Army engineers can't be ordered to do anything. They have to try and persuade them. Dean Keller at 42 has fought these battles before, and he's learned the hard way that you got to pick your battles. And he's much more pragmatic about his approach to things and realizes that without getting the cooperation of the Army and the engineers and the men running, as they refer to it, the devouring bulldozers that were oftentimes risking tearing down buildings that could be repaired, then there's no chance this is going to work. And it really was an experiment that had never been tried before. And the whole genesis of the monuments operation begins in Italy. In fact, saving Italy really is the ground zero of the whole story of the Monuments Men, because we had boots on the ground with the invasion of Sicily in July 1943. And, of course, we wouldn't arrive on the shores of France to Normandy for a whole another year later till June 1944.
So what kinds of instructions were given to the military to avoid really important targets, knowing that they might still have military significance despite the fact that they also contain great works of art?
At the beginning, those instructions were lacking, and it resulted in the first scene I describe at the beginning of the book, which is the near destruction and truly miraculous. If, you know, miracle is one of those words we use every day all the time, and so it loses its meaning. But we say miracle here, we mean miracle.
Yeah.
There's the British and American Army Air Force are bombing Italy. Let me set the stage. In July 1943, Mussolini's removed from office. Negotiations are underway with his successor government to try and get them to switch sides. And those negotiations that are holding quick promise then fade and drag out. And I think the Italians really kind of hoped they could just muddle their way through. And the Allied leaders lost patience. Winston Churchill said, if the Italians don't change sides right away, we're going to give them, quote, all manners of hell. And to prompt them, a decision was made to bomb the industrial cities of northern Italy. And because the American Army Air Force was based in North Africa, they couldn't reach Milan. And so they relied on the British Royal Air Force to do it. As they're flying across Europe to bomb Germany, they just have to swing down on the south side of the Alps. Well, the British bombing policy is firebombing, mm-hmm. and it's targeting the center of cities, and the target was the center city of Milan. There was not really any consideration or concern given to what happens if we hit the Duomo Church in Milan, what happens if we hit the Scala, what happens if we hit the Last Supper. And in fact, both high explosive and firebombs did hit these important landmarks. The Duomo was nicked. The Scala had a direct hit. It was an open-air theater at the time because the roof burned off, and we had a photo from the stage looking up at the open-air sky, something that had never been seen since it was built. And where the Santa Maria della Grazia Church is, there's a dining hall, a long rectangle. The Last Supper by Leonardo is painted on the north end of the wall, one of the narrow walls. And a bomb landed in the courtyard, and it was not a firebomb. That's one of the miracles. It blew out the east wall of the refectory of the dining hall. The roof collapsed, leaving the Last Supper outdoors for the first time ever since the 1490s when it's painted.
You think about curators all over the world needing nitroglycerin or something.
No, it's astonishing. And we include a photograph, which was a photo that we found that I'd never seen before in previous research, that someone had the presence of mind to stand up on the corner of one of the buildings and look down on it at an angle. And it looks like moonscape, with the exception of this scaffolding and sandbags that are bracing the wall, the north wall where the painting is behind it. The Italian superintendents wisely contemplated, suppose. And so they did this in 1940, and if they hadn't done it, there'd be no Da Vinci Code. We'd be reading about the Last Supper in art history books because it would be gone. And it would be two more years before the monuments men would arrive and supervise the removal of all these sandbags to determine, one, was the wall stable enough to hold, and two, what the extent of damage was. So this is a setting in which it begins, and concurrently with that comes the announcement of the formal creation of this group called Monuments, Fine Arts, an archive section, hence the name Monuments Men, that are charged with trying to now start to work with Allied bombing commanders to avoid these kinds of things and steer bombing away from sites like that, taking them into consideration.
I thought it was interesting. Hitler really hated the Pope, hated the Catholic Church, but really did desire the possession of some of these sacred works of art.
Yeah, I mean, Hitler is he's so reactive to things and irrational. I suppose it sounds trite to say these things because they seem obvious, but I remember when we were doing research on Rape of Europa, and we came across this order that he gave to erase St. Petersburg from the face of the earth. And that's not Robert Etzel playing fast and loose with language. That's how the typed order appears. And it goes on and tells his commanders, you must have no mercy in your heart. It doesn't matter whether people are young or old, et cetera. You know, you hear these, you read these things, and you just imagine a soldier going home at night and his wife saying, well, honey, what happened today? The Fuhrer said, we're going to erase this city from the face of the earth. Well, what did you do? I clicked my heels and raised my hand and said, Jawohl. Hmm. So you see in the case of what takes place in Italy, his first inclination, and he's not entirely wrong, is that when Mussolini's removed from office, somehow the Pope is involved with this. The Vatican's involved in working behind the scenes. And so his first reaction is, we're going to march in there. And we're going to pack up all of the things and remove them. And by the way, we're taking the Pope with us. One German general later testified at Nuremberg that they didn't intend to kidnap him. They intended to kill him.
My guest is Robert Etzel. He is founder and president of the Monuments Men Foundation and author of the new book Saving Italy, The Race to Save a Nation's Treasures from the Nazis. You can be part of the conversation and ask a question at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Robert Edsel. He is founder and president of the Monuments Men Foundation and a recipient of the National Humanities Medal. His new book is called Saving Italy, The Race to Save a Nation's Treasures from the Nazis. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Bill in Dallas who asks, was the Pope Hitler intended to kidnap and kill the same Pope who had sent him birthday wishes every year for over a decade?
I don't want to speak out of hand about that. I mean, the Pope Pius XII was the papal envoy to to Germany up until 1929 or so, and then came back. He was a very ambitious Pope who was desirous of seeing this concordat or treaty between the Vatican and Germany. And it was something that he's a controversial figure for every one person that believes the Pope acted and was deliberate in trying to protect Jews and others and speaking out. There's someone out there that feels like he was an ally. He was a de facto ally of the Nazis by not doing all that he should have done. So he's a controversial figure. Even after the war, there were people that were critical of him, and it continues to this day. One author wrote a book called Hitler's Pope, referring to him in that manner. But I don't really get into that. I think that that's a whole another subject and arena for discussion. But I do think it goes to show the audacity of Hitler's immediate knee-jerk reaction. And even the most fanatic Nazis around him, Goebbels and others, attempt to persuade him that you really can't go do this. This is not practical. We should wait a while. Let's let things settle. And they think he's let go of it. And then in September, there's a new figure that we've introduced in this book, an interesting SS general, Karl Wolff, who for 7 years is adjutant to Heinrich Himmler, head of the SS. Wolff was a bad guy. But he does some amazingly good things during this period in Italy in an effort to save his neck, and also because he is a man that's cultivated, and I think he has a desire not to have the works of art in Italy destroyed under his watch. And his first assignment when Hitler sends him to Italy is to be in charge of this plot to go into the Vatican and grab the Pope and the documents there. I don't think this thing ever really got off the ground. Wolff understood the role of the Catholic Church in Italy, that it was really the glue and fiber of the society, and that he pitched Hitler with this idea of letting him do it his way. He referred to it as the easy hand, realizing that the Vatican needed favors, and Wolff, head of the SS, was in a position to grant them. But he also realized, looking out for his own neck, that those favors could run both directions.
So this was at a time when some works were being theoretically sold by the Italians to the Germans, but there was no taxes being paid, and it was like pennies on the dollar. Is that right?
If even that. Hitler would, during his state visit, would see things that he wanted. There was a great sculpture of antiquity, the Discobolus, that he wanted, that Mussolini felt no problem will allow it to be exported. Mussolini is quoted with this immortally ugly quote of his that Italy has too much art, not enough babies. He was really kind of a brutish figure. He wasn't particularly well educated and didn't have any sense of cultivation about museums. As best we could tell, he'd never even been to the Uffizi until he walked through it with Hitler. And he was standing in the back and muttering about how much time they were spending there. Of course, Hitler was in Nirvana. He was so happy to be seeing all these works of art. Goering made requests for works that he'd purchased from private collectors, but they were, in Italy, they refer to it as notificata. They're notified. They're works of art that are so important to the nation as part of their patrimony, they can't be exported under any circumstances. And yet, these things made it to the border with instructions to the customs officials not to open the crates up. Well, if they don't open them up, they can't see what's in them. And, of course, they can't appropriate the proper taxes. And when taxes were due, the Italian ministry paid for them, not the Germans.
Yeah, so they were essentially like, we'll take care of this. Don't worry about it.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. It was a complicated relationship between Mussolini and Hitler.
It was, because for so many years during the 20s, it's hard for people to understand this because we grow up more with the stereotype of Mussolini being the supplicant to Hitler and looking up to him. But in fact, in the 20s, Mussolini was a widely revered figure around the world. There were quotes from American presidents at the time looking up to the economic models he'd brought to Italy during the 20s and 30s. Again, we have to remember about the Depression, worldwide Depression. And Hitler greatly admired him, feeling like his role with fascism in Italy was a model for Germany trying to get back up off the mat. And Hitler always had this affection for Mussolini, even though he didn't trust the Italians. He thought they were weak. He really anticipated correctly that they were going to switch sides. His instincts were completely correct. His knee-jerk reaction of going to the Vatican was absurd. But he was right that they did change sides, and he predicted pretty much when it was going to happen. I think everyone kind of felt like the Allies were trying to negotiate this change of allegiance. The Germans were trying – they didn't have enough troops in Italy to deal with the Italians changing sides. So they needed this grace period, if you will, of a month or two to start flooding the country with troops to be prepared to defend it if, in fact, they were – that's what ended up happening, which it did.
So what was happening on the ground in Italy at the Vatican, at museums, at important architectural sites to try to protect things from what everyone understood was going to be a really bloody conquest?
I think we have to give the Italian superintendents some really high marks, and in particular volunteers there. They understood, because they'd been through World War I, that the country was at great risk because of the amount of works of art that they had, those that could be moved, those that couldn't. There was scaffolding that started to go up on things like the Michelangelo's David, which is on the front cover of the book, a photograph few, if any, viewers will have or listeners will have seen. I'd never seen it. It was entombed in brick out of the same fear that officials in Milan had about the Last Supper. What happens if a bomb hits the roof of the Accademia and the roof collapses? It would destroy this 16-foot-tall marble sculpture. So they entombed it in brick, hoping that that would deflect away a roof collapse. It turned out that that didn't happen in Florence, like what did happen in Milan. Works of art from the Ambrosiana and Brera museums in Milan, from the great churches in Venice, these massive canvases were rolled up, placed on barges, moved through the canals, loaded onto trucks. Everything was an initial effort was to get them out of the cities for fear of Allied bombing, and the bombing then causing fires. The fires are the things everybody's worried about. For all the things that the Italian officials did anticipate, surprisingly, the one thing they really overlooked turned out to be the greatest threat, which is ground combat, ground warfare. And as the Allies succeeded in getting from Sicily to Naples in the fall of 1943 and then ultimately start moving up the peninsula, the works of art are all moved around the country again, and at that stage, the one place that seems the only possible location of safe haven is the Vatican, and Pope Pius XII issues an invitation for these works of art to be brought to the Vatican and be stored there, not knowing whether the Vatican's safe, but feeling if there's any place at all that's safe, it's the Vatican. And ironically, many of the works from the Rome museums and the churches, the great Caravaggios, the paintings from the paintings and sculpture from the Villa Borghese across the town from the Vatican that have moved all around the country up in the north end up right across town in the Vatican. And all the great works of art in Italy, for the most part, were there with the exception of all of the works from Tuscany, from the great Florentine museums that were stuck. They were in the countryside villas and castles, and the superintendent couldn't get them back into the city or move them because the trucks he had been confiscated by the Nazis. And there they sat amidst ground combat all around them.
Of course, the other issue in Italy is frescoes, which are also stuck in place for the most part. Can you talk a little bit about some of the more trying situations?
The great damage during the war was the destruction, severe damage and destruction to some degree of the Mantegna frescoes at the Eremitani Chapel in Padua, one of the great university towns of Italy. This was a mistake by Allied bombers that were targeting rail yards and others and hit it. There was a close call of epic proportions with bombs that fell a few hundred feet away from the Scrovegni Chapel, Giotto's masterpiece. Many feel as important to art and our Western civilization as Leonardo's Last Supper. Fortunately, it survived. But this set the alarm bells off with Monuments Officer Fred Hart, who at the time wasn't a Monuments Officer. He was in the photographic reconnaissance and interpretation, looking at bomb damage assessments, and he sees these photographs, having been on the ground before to these places as a student, and is horrified, runs out into the street. One account had it in tears that these things that had saved him from a really miserable upbringing, looking forward to them and taking care of them, might actually be destroyed. And this is kind of the epiphany for him to plead and barge his way really into the monuments group, writing the leader of the group, Ernst DeWald, saying, you know, the Mantegna frescoes are gone. The Scrovegni Chapel and Giotto's great frescoes were almost destroyed. And if you don't want to see this happen all over the country, you better get me in the Monuments, Fine Arts, and Archives section. Of course, again, you see the impetuousness of him. What really can he do with air commanders? But it leads to improvements. And the Allies, much as they did during ground combat, learning how to fight better, some skills that they take to Normandy, they also learn how to do a better job protecting works of art. This historic Eisenhower directive issued in December 29th, 43, that it's the responsibility not only of his commanders but also his troops, everybody, to protect cultural treasures so much as war allows, pointing out, if it comes down to the lives of our men or an object, the lives of our men count more. But too oftentimes, that's an excuse of convenience. That order is issued 5 months after the Allies have already started the invasion of Italy. By the time they get to Normandy, it's issued 5 weeks before the landings in Normandy. So Eisenhower's learning, too.
Well, that brings us to an email here from Don, who asks if you know about the current policies of the U.S. military regarding preservation of cultural artifacts and sites that are engaged in combat operations.
Don is asking a good question. It's one of the reasons I created and founded the Monuments Men Foundation. I appreciate your references there. In fact, it was the foundation that received the National Humanities Medal for the President for our efforts to save this legacy before all these guys and women were gone. But unfortunately, their legacy was forgotten after World War II, and there was no effort to employ the idea of concept of monuments officers in any war fought since through Iraq. And of course, we paid a horrible price for it as a nation in the aftermath of the looting of the National Museum of Iraq. And the museum gets the most attention, but their national archives was gutted. A lot of their records were deliberately flooded by bad guys. And we had troops there, but no one had the presence of mind to make sure that those troops had orders to go and protect these cultural sites, in addition to the oil facilities, the electrical facilities. I mean, nothing wrong with protecting those things. We got to have fuel to move trucks around and got to have power to keep the lights going. But it was a horrible, horrible mistake, and we managed to inflame the opinion of a billion people around the world in the Islamic world that somehow this was a deliberate effort on the part of American forces because we didn't care about Islamic art. That's nonsense. But troops are not entrepreneurs. They take orders from the top. There are today cultural preservation officers in that are trained. They don't have the backgrounds that these monuments officers did, where they're coming out of museum world. They're trying to train military officers to have a sensitivity to this as a result of all the mistakes that were made in Iraq. It's my opinion and the opinion of the foundation that while this is important work, that a bottom-up effort is not going to succeed when we get into conflicts, that it's got to be top-down, and we need the CEO of the country, and that's the president, to, in my opinion, just restate the words of President Roosevelt and General Eisenhower. It worked then, and I, you know, in response to Don, I would say rhetorically, if we can do as well as we did during a world war with the loss of 65 million people, no technology, these monuments officers hitchhiking across Europe, no more than 45 monuments officers in Italy by the end of the war, no more than 110 in all of Northern Europe. Surely we can do better, not to make light of the difficulties in these smaller regional conflicts, than we did in Iraq. And that's the work of the foundation. Part of the work is to preserve these guys' legacy for the past, but to put it to use and raise public awareness. And I believe if Don and all your listeners out there learn about the story of the Monuments Men, whether it's the last book or Saving Italy or the Clooney movie, politicians pay attention to what voters know, and voters go see movies and read books.
Do you think part of the issue is that Americans still have a sort of Eurocentric view of what's culturally important in the world because so many of the people who have run this country historically trace their roots to Europe?
I think that's a common I think it's a very logical conclusion, and I think it's a common criticism. But no, I don't think that's the case. You know, the great collectors in Western Europe that Hitler looted, including so many Jewish collectors, had works of art from the Islamic world, works of art from antiquities, from Egypt, from Colombian works of art. They acquired whatever was great and valuable. They didn't only look at Eurocentric or Christian-oriented or Old Testament art. They just bought whatever was great. And Hitler stole whatever was great. He wasn't necessarily discriminating either, unless it got into works of art he considered degenerate, the more impressionist, post-impressionist, modern works of art that he felt reflected some dysfunction of people to not be able to see nature as it actually existed. I think what happened in Iraq, I don't think it was targeting them. There were plenty of archaeologists and other leaders in the museum world that went to the State Department, Defense Department before the invasions and said, look, if you're really serious about doing this, you better be careful about this, this, and this, and so on. But it lost steam working its way up the bureaucracy because, in my opinion, without having that order come from the top saying that the United States respects the cultural property of others, this was a priority of General Eisenhower during World War II. The United States and Great Britain set the standard for protection of cultural treasures during war, and it's a standard that we've since lost. And we have engendered a lot of negative will towards the United States as a result of this because people around the world are impassioned about their culture and their patrimony. And it's something that we don't necessarily have to like it or agree with it. We just need to understand it and respect it.
Robert Edsel is with us. He is founder and president of the Monuments Men Foundation, and he has a new book out called Saving Italy, The Race to Save a Nation's Treasures from the Nazis. His 2010 book, The Monuments Men, is currently being made into a movie directed, written, and starring George Clooney. If you would like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Robert Edsel. He is founder and president of the Monuments Men Foundation and author of the new book Saving Italy, The Race to Save a Nation's Treasures from the Nazis. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. You know, you mentioned earlier, you know, these guys backpacking across Italy and across other parts of Europe. That's not an overstatement. That's true. And in many cases, they're fighting for resources. They're saying we need some trucks and being told you have to wait because the military campaign comes first.
Yeah, when Dean Keller is finally assigned to be the lead monuments officer for U.S. Fifth Army, they also provide him with a Jeep, which he's beside himself with excitement that he's actually going to be able to do his job and have transportation. Now, that sounds preposterous, but the very first monuments officer ever, who was a classics professor from Harvard, and for anyone that's been to Harvard, you all know who Mason Hammond is, because if you graduated from there, he read your commencement address, unless you graduated during the war years. He was there from the 20s all the way up to 1999 when he died, and he read commencement every single year. And Mason Hammond got to Sicily. He thought he was being assigned to North Africa, and the last minute they told him he was going to Sicily. And he said, well, I don't really know anything about Sicily. And, well, that's where you're going. So he tried to go to the library to study books and guides about Italy, and the military intelligence said, well, you can't go. The Germans have spies everywhere. They may figure out that's where we're headed. And he said, well, how am I supposed to do my job? Well, that's not our problem. So this is how it went. And Hammond for months was trying to hitchhike his way around Sicily to get to these various locations and effect temporary repairs, which was what the monuments officer's first charge, and would pick up local vehicles that were just beat to pieces. They referred to them as monuments themselves. These cars were so old, and constantly jerry-rigging jalopies to get around the country. So when Dean Keller received this Jeep right away, he understood Mason Hammond was the one that had paved the way for that for 4 months not having transportation.
What kinds of negotiations took place behind closed doors, sometimes outside the notice of the people at the top, between Nazis and the Allies?
Carl Wolf is the key to this story, and there was a lot of theorizing on my part about where the story was going to go as we were doing research. You come up with ideas and follow your instincts, and in this case, they played out. We were able to document that Wolf is a guy who he's been a banker between the wars. He's been an advertising executive. He's very articulate. He is a favorite of Hitler because he has this Aryan appearance. He's very tall and aristocratic looking, blonde haired.
And yet, excuse me for interrupting, came late to the game in terms of joining the Nazi Party.
He does. He's not one of these, they referred to him as Septemberlings, people that joined the party when it seemed to be favorable and advantageous for them. Wolf isn't in that group of thugs that are surrounding Hitler, and his good fortune is when he gets assigned to Italy, he's outside their immediate watch all the time. So he's the number – co-ranking leading German officer in Italy along with Field Marshal Kesselring. If you want to think of it like this, Kesselring's in charge of the troops facing the outward toward the Allies trying to defeat them, and Wolf's troops, the SS, are maintaining order in the country, handling supplies, handling things internally, really guarding Germany's back door. And Wolf, by December 1944, realizes Nazi Germany's not going to win this war. He's got two families, not one. His first family, as a student, young Wolf didn't attend his biology classes because he got married to a brunette-haired woman expecting blonde-haired kids, and it just wasn't going to occur, and it didn't. So he divorced her and married another woman eventually that was blonde, and he had to seek the divorce from Hitler directly. Himmler would not give him permission to do this, and he went over Himmler's head, which created quite a strain in the relationship for a period of time. And he was remarried with a second family, and he wanted to save his two families. He wanted to save his own neck. By this time, the Allies have already made it clear they're going to be war crime trials. And he knows, as an officer of the SS, 7 years by the side of Himmler when he's visiting these concentration camps, and in some cases himself signing orders facilitating the movement of trains with the chosen people, as the Nazis referred to them, moving to concentration camps, that he's right in the gun sights of these potential prosecutions. And he comes up with a plan to surrender all German forces in Italy that has various incentives to it. One is the scorched earth plans that Hitler has for northern Italy. Wolf will agree to not implement those orders. One is to protect a number of political prisoners that are within the SS's camps. But one of the others is he's got control over all the works of art that have been removed from the Florentine museums, and he agrees to make sure that they're safe and that he will tender them to the Americans.
And Wolf was not tried at Nuremberg, is that right?
That's correct. And it's an extraordinary story that is a story within a story. Wolf, in February and early March 1945, removes his military uniform, his SS uniform, and puts on civilian clothes and gets on a train and secretly gets out of his headquarters in northern Italy to go into Zurich and meet with Alan Dulles, who's America's senior spymaster in Europe. He's head of the OSS, the precursor to the CIA, to pitch this plan to him. And Dulles is under very strict orders from the president that there will be no deals or negotiations with any Nazi officers. He can go and listen, but under no circumstances is he to offer any incentive or anything like that. And to his grave, Dulles insisted, I made no deals with Wolf. There's nothing in writing. We haven't offered any incentives whatsoever. But Dulles, but Wolf ultimately did pull the surrender off. It was the very first surrender of German forces during the war, 3 days before the end of the war in Europe, before VE Day. And after the war, he did go to Nuremberg, but as a witness for the prosecution, not as a defendant. And although he was later tried in subsequent trials that Germany had for people that they felt like had been missed, he was not tried as part of the primary defendants at Nuremberg. And yet he and Kaltbrunner, Ernst Kaltbrunner, who we did hang at Nuremberg, were really the two highest-ranking surviving SS officers after the war. Himmler, of course, killed himself.
Keller and Hart both were buried in Italy.
They were. It's one of the most heartwarming aspects of this story. As a dad, I started off and told you this same age I was with my son. Keller is trying to figure out, over and above this enormous task he has, head of Fifth Army, how to continue to be a dad to a son that's 4,000 miles away. And he realizes, well, my boy can't read, but he can look at drawings, and I'm an artist. So he sends home hundreds of drawings to his boy of him sewing on his military patch, bathing out of his helmet, crossing a ravine where the bridge is blown out on a pulley. And this is a language between the father and son that lasts their entire lifetimes. And Keller's great contribution, over and above all the recovery of these stolen works of art, was to save the Campo Santo that you referred to earlier, the medieval cemetery in Pisa that was built in 1278 that houses the great leaders of Pisa. It really was the reason everyone went to Pisa. The Leaning Tower is a modern invention post-war, but the Campo Santo has 20,000 square feet of frescoes, 3,000 more square feet than are in the Sistine Chapel. And it was severely burned and damaged. Keller arrived in time to save it. The restoration work continues to this day, and his son, the boy that received all these touching drawings during the war, made sure that the remains of his father were buried in the Campo Santo. And I can tell you from living in Italy, papal intercession can't pull something like that off, but it was the love the Italians had. And Fred Hart did similar work in Florence, saving so many of the ancient towers that were at risk of being torn down because they were severely damaged, but he understood the difference between those that could be repaired and those that were unsalvageable. And he's buried in Florence up on the one of the churches up on the hill, San Miniato, which overlooks the town of Florence. So it's an incredible conclusion and a fitting conclusion to the contribution these two men made that Italians, that oftentimes are very Italian-centric, embrace them with their hearts, making them honorary citizens and honoring them in such a prominent way.
We had an email earlier from someone who wanted to know if you recommend reading your two books in chronological order. Do you go first to The Monuments Men and then to Saving Italy, or does it matter?
I don't think it matters. If I was to do it in reverse, if I was to do it over again, I would probably write Saving Italy first, now that I have a fuller comprehension. And, you know, some have said, well, why didn't you wait and, you know, do all the research and understand the whole picture before you wrote anything? And
it's a big picture to understand.
It's a big picture. You know, one time we tried to figure out, well, how many books are there about just D-Day, Normandy, June 6th? We got to like 1,000 and stopped counting. I mean, I don't even know how many books there are about World War II. When you consider that the story of the Monuments Men involves the closure of all the museums in Europe for 5 years, that all the works of art in Europe were on bomb-cratered roads, oftentimes being strafed or bombed by Allied pilots. I mean, all 13 out of 15 works of art by Leonardo da Vinci on the road somewhere. It's an epic story. This is not a small asterisk of World War II that got overlooked. This is a major story that hasn't been told, that we're still writing the final chapter of the story today because of all the hundreds of thousands of works that are still missing, that part of the work of the foundations, identifying those things and helping them get back. But I've been in my own race against time, as has the foundation, to try and tell the story so that we can honor as many of these monuments officers and their families while they're still alive to be honored. There were 17 that I knew on my watch that I've interviewed and countless more family members of those that had passed. Today, there are only 5, 1 woman and 4 men. So we've done the best we can do to go as expediently as we can, considering the difficulty and cumbersome of this research. And unlike a lot of writing of history, we're trying to find the living participants to gather the information information. All of our history is not in archives because so many people never researched this before. They're out there with the living participants in their letters home during the war and other documents. So there's an enormous amount of detective work on our part, and we're working in four separate languages, translating tens of thousands of documents. It's a cumbersome effort. But I think either way, someone's going to be thrilled with the story, and I really don't think it matters, because the conclusions that we're able to come up with in the aftermath, I think, give the perspective, and I don't think anyone's going to miss anything going either way.
I take it you were inundated with film offers once The Monuments Men came out in 2010. What caused you to wait for the offer you finally received from George Clooney?
Well, I suppose somewhat surprisingly, we did have some contacts initially, but I wouldn't say inundated, but there were certainly a lot of tire kickers, and then there were some that were very legitimate people. But I wanted somebody that felt as passionate about the story as I do, or at least someone that could hold out that kind of sense and that understood the importance of it. And I was so impressed when I went out to see George the first time and his partner, Grant Heslov. I spent 5 days with them all day long every day. They were enormous students. I've talked to them a number of times since then. I'm a consultant on the film. I've been over there several times. I'm headed back in June. They are so dedicated to this story, and I think, you know, it's a great story. It's going to move people to laughter. It's going to move them to tears. It's going to be entertaining. That's what people want to go see movies about. But I also think they're going to realize the heroism and the enormous contribution and the gold standard that was set by the United States leadership. And I think, you know, when you consider George Clooney and Grant Heslov, they're both artists. They're both business people. But the chance to play artists in a film as artists – involved in saving all the great art and cultural treasures of Western civilization in an epic film with a cast like this, you could look a lifetime as an actor and not find something like that. And I think they realize what a great opportunity is. And I know that the other actors, you know, these are people that are at the top of their game. They can do anything they want to do. And they chose to do this. And they've got several years of their lives involved in the telling of it. So I think it's going to change the world we live in, this film is, because it's not going to be okay for politicians to overlook the protection of cultural treasures anymore, like what happened in Iraq, because they're going to realize there's, in this country, 300 million voters that know this story now and know who Monuments Men are. It's not going to be Allied forces anymore. It's going to be like Tuskegee Airmen. It's going to be like 101st Airborne Screaming Eagles and Monuments Men. People are going to say, oh, yeah, those are the people that saved all the art that we go enjoy today when we make these visits and we get to see in books that wouldn't be here if it wasn't for them.
As an author, does it bother you that there are people who won't read nonfiction books and won't see documentaries who will race to the movie theater to see a fictionalized account?
No, not really. I mean, I think they're following the story pretty well. And, you know, it's their interpretation of the book. But the overarching elements of the story are there. I mean, people are going to know the things that are important for them to know. And so I take a much more pragmatic view than a lot of authors that I think sometimes tend to be stick in the muds about, you know, I'm not happy because they didn't follow this. Look, they're artists. This is their chance to interpret the story. I've had my chance. If someone wants to know all the gory details, read my book. If they want to know the story, it's a way to reach people I can't reach. And we're going to probably have 1 billion people know the story of the Monuments Men because of this film, and no book can ever approach that kind of success. So I'm honored.
Robert Edsel is founder and president of the Monuments Men Foundation. His new book is called Saving Italy, The Race to Save a Nation's Treasures from the Nazis. Robert, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining
Thank
us.
Thank you, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. We had Jeff Whittington on the phones. He's also our executive producer. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. You can check out that podcast at kera.org/think. And of course, we always welcome comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.